ABC News.
Well, the warnings are given by people who have more information than us, and I can only assume that, that there's an abundance of caution there. But the problem is, Glenn, that there are extremists unaccounted for, there are explosive materials unaccounted for, and at the very least, if these people are confronted in an attempt to arrest them, they're likely to detonate. So whether they have the liberty to plan further explosions, that risk is there. And it would seem sensible to err on the side of caution.
All right. Now, Sri Lankan officials have revised down the death toll from the bombings from 359 to 255. That's a huge difference. What do you make of that?
Well, firstly, it's always good news to hear the less people have died. That's got to be welcomed. Secondly, to acknowledge they're dealing with a gruesome business. They're dealing often not with bodies but body parts. So trying to figure out a death toll would be very hard work and very grim. But it does speak to the fact that the authorities are clearly struggling with capacity. Normally in natural disasters, you don't have this sort of reversal, even in terrorist events. And so it suggests that they're really not quite on top of things. And that would explain the advice to err on the side of caution, because if you can't be sure that they can properly count the dead, then we can't be sure they can properly protect the living either.
All right. Now, 5 days on, the Sri Lankan Prime Minister's admitted intelligence failures occurred, and there's a mix of anger and incredulity that warnings about potential attacks weren't passed on. How much was this potentially driven by domestic Sri Lankan politics?
It seems to be largely driven by domestic Sri Lankan politics. To be fair to the Sri Lankan authorities, there was no reason to expect there to be problems in Sri Lanka. The 2 million-plus Muslim community was peaceful and very much against extremism and had never historically presented any signs of extremism. It itself, like the Christian minority, generally been the victims of more recently Sinhalese Buddhist extremism, before that Tamil Tiger extremism. But they were given specific intelligence briefings by the Research and Analysis Wing in India's chief intelligence body, RAW. RAW repeatedly 3 or 4 times passed information on it. It had interrogated people in its own territory who told of plans for terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka. And those communications were not passed up the line, partly because there's been a feud between the president and the prime minister. The president's in charge of security in the Sri Lankan system. He's the head of state and head of government. And he tried to install a new prime minister last October, failed in a constitutional crisis, but hasn't obviously been in good terms with the Prime Minister. So the Prime Minister said that he and his ministers hadn't been included in security briefings. That must have contributed to a large measure to what's been described as an intelligence failure, but really is a political failure.
Now, the authorities are still searching for suspects, as you say. What do we know about who was behind it and what help they may have had?
Well, the group that's been specifically mentioned, this is a group that the Indian authorities had mentioned, is National Tawhid Jama'a. The name simply means the National Monotheist Community. It's a sort of very generic name that lots of religious groups use. This particular group, however, was known for its extreme views and was led by one particular individual who was increasingly causing grief to his own Muslim community. They approached authorities about his hateful sermons. In a context less peaceful than Sri Lanka, such a preacher perhaps wouldn't have drawn such attention, but he was still seen to be just a hateful extremist, not a violent extremist, not a terrorist. So it comes as a surprise, not just that he should turn from spewing hatred, but to actually leading a terror attack, but that he should have the capacity to put together very powerful explosive devices and pull off timed, coordinated attacks, a pair of triple attacks, 3 in a church and then a little later 3 simultaneously in luxury hotels. And that, frankly, speaks to what Islamic State has claimed, that they were behind it, because no group could go from having no capacity to doing what is one of the world's largest terror attacks, even with a revised death toll, without having some assistance. And this seems to be a new kind of hybrid attack in which Islamic State sends people, perhaps sends componentry, certainly sends technical expertise in, and assists a local group who otherwise wouldn't be able to pull off such an attack. And this seems to be what Islamic State intends to do wherever it can see political weakness. It's, of course, done it before. We've seen trouble in southern Philippines in 2017. It engineered a siege in the city of Marawi, the largest Muslim city, that went on for 5 months. And people there reported that the method of fighting was similar to that observed in Iraq. So this ability to transfer capacity at a distance is well proven, but Still comes as a surprise to see it happening in Sri Lanka.
ABC News.